Lecture 29. Nationalists, Ambedkar, Bose, and Jinnah.
During the first half of the 20th century, as India began to emerge from colonialism, a range of people worked to assert many competing models for their nation to come. Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi was the most famous of these. While his vision for India and his innovative tactics of nonviolent non-cooperation remained dominant during the period leading up to independence in 1947, other leaders clashed with him. Each developed his own model for the nation and implemented his own means for achieving it. As it turned out, following independence, these other models actually had more substantial effects than did Gandhi's. In this lecture, we'll consider some of the major alternative models and means by looking at the careers and ideas of three significant leaders, each of whom opposed Gandhi over fundamental issues. First, while Gandhi claimed to represent the interests of the oppressed people who had been treated as untouchables for many centuries, the actual main leader of that community, Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar, repeatedly conflicted with Gandhi. Instead, Ambedkar advanced his own policies to advance his own community. Indeed, Ambedkar, as the chairman of India's Constitution Writing Committee and first Indian law minister, actually had more of an effect on the new nation's legal system than did Gandhi. Second, we'll look at Subhas Chandra Bose. As a fiery young leader, Bose at first rose up in Gandhi's shadow, but he differed deeply about the value of violence in achieving Indian independence, and also about the need for a strong central government to lead India into the modern world. Unlike Gandhi, Bose was willing to make alliances with evil men in order to beat the British. Last, we'll turn to Muhammad Ali Jinnah, widely credited with the partition of India by creating Pakistan as a new nation for Muslims. While Jinnah and Gandhi actually shared a similar background and both claimed to be working for the best interests of Muslims, their methods and models soon diverged. So, through our look at these three major leaders, we can appreciate how uncertain and conflicted were the array of movements as India and Pakistan moved toward independence. Being born as a so-called untouchable, even in the late 19th century, almost certainly meant a life of degradation. Yet a combination of admirable ability and unusual opportunity enabled Dr. B.R. Ambedkar to lead his community and his emerging nation forward. Ambedkar was a Mahar by Jati or caste. Maharas traditionally worked as untouchable village servants. That is, when the headman or a governing council of a village needed a job done, they customarily had a Mahar do it. Sometimes this was demeaning work, like clearing a ditch or enforcing a punishment decreed by the village authorities. In exchange, Mahars often received small plots of land to farm. Some worked as tenant farmers for high caste landlords. Mahars faced the many oppressions that the Hindu caste system imposed on untouchables. Their touch or even shadow was literally considered to defile high caste people. They had to live in separate, poorer parts of the village. But Maharas were not at the absolute bottom of the social hierarchy. In most villages, they were caste ranked below even them, like leather tanners and people who clean away human waste. In their homeland of Western India, Maharas are one of the largest communities. So when full democracy was implemented and people could vote freely, each with an equal vote, Maharas collectively achieved substantial electoral power. Ambedkar is widely credited for gaining this power for Mahars and other ex-untouchables. For Ambedkar and his followers, the idea of democracy and the use of civil rights law became very attractive, even if they were British models. For example, in 1919, the British colonial government created quotas called reservations for untouchables in government employment and education, in proportion to the percentage of untouchables in Indian society. That enabled enterprising and lucky untouchables to begin to rise up economically and educationally from their traditional degraded place. But discrimination by others in Indian society continued nonetheless. Indeed, Ambedkar personally got his start because of the British colonial system. His family had managed to escape its traditional place in society by joining the British Indian Army. While the British had their own racial stereotypes, they also recognized individual talent. But Ambedkar's father, like other Indians, was not allowed to be a king's commissioned officer. That was reserved for white Britons. Nor was he allowed to serve in the more prestigious infantry, artillery, or cavalry. Instead, he was in the supply department that supported these other branches of the army. Still, that meant that Ambedkar could attend state primary school. However, most teachers and other students treated him as an untouchable. He faced insulting behavior daily, including having to sit in a separate room with a segregated water supply. But his innate talent and hard work still made him stand out. He was able to gain admission to secondary school and graduate, one of the first in his family to do so. He then graduated from Bombay University, again, as a pathbreaker for his entire community. The local Indian prince of Baroda was unusually progressive. He awarded Ambedkar a small scholarship in 1913 to study at Columbia University in the US. This made Ambedkar the absolute first of his entire community to get an advanced postgraduate education. While living and studying in New York, Ambedkar learned much, both in class and without. He concentrated in economics and political science, earning 2 master's degrees in 3 years. He also saw how African Americans lived in Harlem during the pre-World War I years that led up to the Harlem Renaissance. He then researched and wrote a Columbia University doctoral thesis in economics, completed in 1927. In part, he analyzed the economic basis for discriminatory Hindu caste system practices. Advancing his qualifications even further, Ambedkar earned a law degree in London and 2 more masters and a 2nd doctorate from the London School of Economics. On his return to India, Ambedkar was employed by the princely administration of Baroda, today called Vadodara. But despite his higher degrees and undeniable abilities, most other Indian officials still treated him as an untouchable. So he was compelled to quit. He briefly held a faculty position in a business school in Bombay, but again he faced discrimination from the other teachers who would not let him drink water from their supply. So he worked as a political leader and a lawyer, using the British-run courts to defend his people. He started social reform movements. He also became an influential journalist, using the developing print media to publish articles, journals, pamphlets, and books in English and his native Marathi language, demanding civil rights for his community. He found some support from liberals within the British colonial administration. But other British officials sought to harness his social work into their divide and rule strategy. If untouchables could be divided from the Hindu community, it would further fragment opposition to the British Raj. So untouchables led by Ambedkar, Muslims led by Jinnah, Hindus led by the Indian National Congress, and Indian princes were all given voices in the negotiations, for example, at the Round Table conferences in London of 1930 and 32. Ambedkar remained convinced that Hinduism could not free itself from caste discrimination. In this, he clashed with Gandhi. For Gandhi, the degrading Hindu practices of untouchability were morally wrong. He worked with Ambedkar to enable untouchables to enter Hindu temples and to get access to public water sources, for example. But Gandhi believed it was higher caste people who needed to change and to start treating all people as full human beings. Mahars and other oppressed people should continue to perform their traditional manual labor jobs, but Gandhi wanted them to receive the same respect as everyone else. Gandhi urged them to make sure they kept their homes clean and to stop drinking alcohol and eating meat. Gandhi even created a new name, Harjan, or beloved of the Hindu god Vishnu, for them. Gandhi began occasionally living in Harijan neighborhoods, although the houses where he stayed had to be absolutely clean. For Ambedkar, many of Gandhi's words and actions were only cover-ups for continued discrimination and impoverishment. Gandhi could choose to live occasionally in a Harijan house, but most Mahars and other untouchables had no choice about where they could live. Nor, Ambedkar forcefully argued, should untouchables try to imitate the values and behavior of high-caste people and hope to gain their respect. Instead, Ambedkar worked to get political and economic power for his people. He also used the British colonial law courts and government to force change on the Indian social system. For example, Ambedkar advocated for separate electorates where only untouchables could vote and only an untouchable candidate could win. Muslims had gained political power from such separate electorates since 1909, so untouchables should have them too. Gandhi adamantly opposed Ambedkar's demand, since separate electorates only divided what should be a united India. When Ambedkar insisted and the British concurred, Gandhi went on a public fast until death against this. Ambedkar saw Gandhi as using moral blackmail. Should Gandhi die over the issue, untouchables would be blamed. So reluctantly, Ambedkar gave ground. He and Gandhi negotiated the Pune Pact of 1932. This reserved 18% of voting districts for untouchables, where only an untouchable candidate could win. But everybody, except Muslims, voted in those constituencies. So the winning untouchable candidate had to appeal to the majority of the voters who were not untouchables. Gandhi stopped his fast, but Ambedkar never reconciled with him. Ambedkar later wrote, quote, "What is there in Gandhianism which is not to be found in Orthodox Hinduism? All that Gandhism has done is to find a philosophic justification for Hinduism and its dogmas, a veritable chamber of horrors," end quote. After independence was achieved, Ambedkar led the committee that drafted the new Indian constitution. He made sure that untouchability was absolutely forbidden. He could not change the Pune Pact, but the new constitution continued the special quotas in government employment and state education for untouchables, as well as having quotas for Adivasi forest dwellers. In the first independent Indian government, Ambedkar served as law minister. He made sure that these constitutionally guaranteed rights were actually enforced. But in 1951, he left government to devote himself full-time to journalism and social activism for his community. Ambedkar believed that Hinduism was never going to change, so he determined to renounce it. He had long sought another religion for his people. Islam, Sikhism, and Christianity all deny inequality among their believers. But in practice in India, none of these religious communities actually treated all of their members equally. Untouchables who converted to them remained subject to discrimination. Plus, Islam and Christianity originated outside of India. So, just months before his death, Ambedkar converted to Buddhism. Buddhism had several attractive advantages. Its theology promised status based on personal achievement, not birth. Buddhism had originated in India, so it was not a foreign religion. Plus, there had been very few Buddhists in India for nearly a millennium, so there was no existing community that could assert its authority over these new converts. Thus, Ambedkar led 500,000 of his followers, mostly Mahars, in a dramatic public mass conversion to Buddhism in 1956. Millions more converted later. But even today, the term neo-Buddhist often means in practice a Mahar. So the struggles by ex-untouchables continue, nearly 60 years after Ambedkar's death. Today, many in his community call themselves Dalit, meaning the ground-down ones. Like the American Black Panther movement, there was a Dalit Panther movement with powerful poetry and other cultural assertions of their distinctive identity. Ambedkar, fondly called Babasaheb, remains a celebrated hero to many Dalit movements and political parties. In statues and images of him, he's almost always portrayed in a British-style suit and tie, wearing glasses, to show how he used modern education and universal civil rights for the advancement of his people. Many anti-British Indians believed that violence was necessary. One of the stereotypes of the British Raj was that Indians, especially Hindus, were effeminate and incapable of self-rule. So Indian leaders who advocated violence often wanted to prove that Hindus were as manly and martial as anyone else. Even teenage Gandhi experimented with eating meat to make himself more masculine, imitating both the British and Muslims who had conquered and ruled Hindus for centuries. S.C. Bose became a leading advocate for violence as the only effective way to expel the British and simultaneously restore Indian self-esteem. Bose came from a professional Bengali family. By jati, they were kayasths, with administration as their traditional caste occupation. Even as a student, Bose forcefully opposed the British colonial system. He was expelled from Presidency College, Calcutta, when he took responsibility for the beating of a British teacher, even though he probably did not actually commit the assault himself. In 1919, he went to London to take the entrance examination for the Indian Civil Service, the elite cadre administering India. Although Bose was so smart and knowledgeable that he earned an excellent score, he then rejected serving the British Raj. He had only taken the exam to prove to the British and to himself that he could succeed. Instead, Bose joined the Indian National Congress movement at age 24. He soon rose to lead its young activists. He edited pro-independence newspapers. But he increasingly opposed Gandhi's program of nonviolence and village economic self-sufficiency. Bose organized a paramilitary volunteer corps with himself as the general officer commanding. Indeed, Bose was sympathetic to those Indians who were using terrorism against the British. He would be jailed 11 times by the British over the next two decades, often without any trial. His health suffered greatly from his harsh imprisonments. Further, Bose explicitly opposed Gandhi's policies against industrialization. Bose critiqued Gandhi in 1928 by saying Gandhi believed, quote, "Modernism is bad, large-scale production is an evil, wants should not be increased, and the standard of living should not be raised, that we must endure for the best of our ability to go back to the days of the bullock cart, and that the soul is so important physical culture and military training can well be ignored," close quote. Instead, Bose wanted India to use modern science to industrialize and to use military-type training to strengthen its people, all while not losing its own distinctive culture. Bose personally interviewed Mussolini about how fascism was modernizing and disciplining Italy. With support of more militant members of the Indian National Congress, Bose was elected its president in 1938. While he continued to differ from Gandhi, Bose was re-elected the next year. But then Gandhi used his own influence to block Bose's policies and forced him to resign. Instead, Bose formed the All India Forward Bloc within the Congress Party, demanding immediate independence. He also argued that only a 20-year-long authoritarian iron dictatorship would purge Indian society of its problems, like the escalating Hindu-Muslim conflicts. During World War II, Bose asserted that Indians should take advantage of British weakness. In 1941, he dramatically escaped from house arrest in Calcutta. He traveled in disguise through Afghanistan, to Moscow, and then on to Rome, and then Berlin. With Hitler's support, Bose started broadcasting radio messages to India calling for a violent revolution against the British Raj. Indeed, in 1942, there were mass uprisings by Indian workers and peasants in the Quit India movement that Gandhi had initiated, but which more violent leaders were inflaming. Bose also arranged with the German High Command to let him organize Indian prisoners of war to fight against the British as the Free Indian Legion. These were soldiers of the British Indian Army who had been captured by the Germans in North Africa. While some of the few thousand Indian Legion soldiers did defend France against the Allies, they were too small in number to make much of a military contribution to the Axis war effort. So in 1943, Bose traveled perilously by German submarine around the southern tip of Africa to rendezvous with a Japanese submarine. The Japanese Imperial Army had captured some 70,000 Indian soldiers, many of them abandoned by their British officers when Singapore fell suddenly early in 1942. The Japanese then released about 40,000 of these prisoners of war so they could form the Indian National Army and invade India under Bose's command. He also gained much support from Indians living in Burma, which the Japanese had also captured. Bose also led the Provisional Government of Free India as Prime Minister and Head of State. While small parts of India fell to the Indian National Army, the war was already entering its final stages. The INA took heavy losses, and the Japanese could not provide enough support to defeat the Allied British Indian Army, British Royal Army, US forces, and ANZAC, that is, Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. When the Japanese finally surrendered unconditionally in August 1945, so did the Indian National Army. Bose himself tried to escape to continue the war of liberation, only to have his overloaded plane crash in Taiwan. Some Indians still see him as the inspiring figure for India's modern future as a militarily and economically strong world power. This was far from the model of India that Gandhi wanted, but Bose's vision has increasingly been achieved in the last few decades. After all, the Indian Army is the third largest in the world. It has fought four wars with its neighbors, and it is armed with nuclear weapons. Further, India is an emerging global economic power. All this is much closer to Bose's vision than to Gandhi's. Even more disappointing for Gandhi during his last years was seeing India violently divided into two separate nations that immediately began fighting and have repeatedly done so in the decades that have followed. The man widely given credit or blame for opposing Gandhi and creating Pakistan is M.A. Jinnah, to whom we'll turn next. In background, upbringing, and professional training, Gandhi and Jinnah were actually quite alike, even if they grew to differ profoundly. Both came from Gujarati Hindu mercantile families on India's northwestern coast, but Jinnah's family had converted to Islam a few generations earlier. Their families shared many customs, like arranging marriages very early. Gandhi began married life at 13, Jinnah was about 16, and his wife about 14 when they married. However, Jinnah's first wife died right after he went to London in 1893. For 3 years, he trained as a barrister, just like Gandhi. In fact, Jinnah arrived in London less than 2 years after Gandhi had returned to India. Both men also anglicized in London, for example, by donning elegant English suits. Although Jinnah continued to mostly dress that way throughout his life, Gandhi eventually abandoned them as not Indian enough. Jinnah also had a far more successful legal career than Gandhi. As we know, Gandhi admitted that he had failed as a lawyer when he first returned to India. But Jinnah soon made himself a leading and very prosperous member of the Bombay Bar. He was then its only Muslim barrister. At age 29, Jinnah also joined the young Indian National Congress Party, even before Gandhi had done so. Jinnah was among the most articulate members of the INC and one of the few Muslims in it. He rose quickly in its leadership. In 1909, Jinnah was elected to the Muslim Reserve seat for Bombay on the advisory Indian Legislative Council. As a financially successful lawyer, Jinnah moved in the highest social circles in Bombay. He met and fell in love with Ratanbai Petit, the young and highly fashionable daughter of a rich Parsi. Her family refused to allow her to marry him, so she and Jinnah waited until she converted to Islam, taking the new name Maryam, and turned 18 before they could wed. However, they eventually separated, and she died a decade later. Their only child, a daughter, grew distant from Jinnah. Instead, Jinnah eventually had his own younger sister, Fatima, manage his luxurious household. Jinnah did not join the Muslim League until 1913, 7 years after it was founded. Most of the leaders of the Muslim League were rich landholders. They recognized that only Jinnah had the political and legal skills to advance their cause. So, just 3 years after he joined the Muslim League, Jinnah was elected its official permanent president. As a leading member of both the Indian National Congress and the Muslim League, Jinnah was at first celebrated as, quote, the best ambassador of Hindu-Muslim unity. He pushed for coordinated policies. The Congress and the Muslim League held joint sessions in 1915 and 1916. Under Jinnah's leadership, they formalized this cooperation in the Lucknow Pact of 1916 that promised to share power. That is, in Hindu-majority provinces, Muslims would receive disproportionate legislative representation, and vice versa. Hence, Jinnah declared in 1928, quote, "What we want is that Hindus and Muslims should march together until our object is obtained. Our two communities have got to be reconciled and united and made to feel that their interests are common and that they are marching together for a common goal. We are all sons of this land. We have to live together. We have to work together. Believe me, there is no progress for India until Muslims and Hindus are united. Nothing will make me more happy than to see the Hindu-Muslim union." Close quote. By calling Hindus and Muslims communities, Jinnah indicated the mainly cultural basis for the distinctions between them. So he advocated at that time for the united goal of being part of one nation, although there needed to be legal and political protections for the Muslim minority community within free India. But Jinnah felt ever less respected in the Congress. Gandhi mobilized much support from India's countryside, in part by evoking Hindu symbols. He also tried to be incorporative of all religious traditions. As Gandhi's influence over the Congress rose, Jinnah realized that his own vision of the future was no longer being supported. So he resigned from the Congress in 1920. Then in 1930, Jinnah retired from politics. He moved to London for the next 4 years, where he developed a lucrative legal practice. The 1935 Government of India Act led to the first provincial elections in 1937, with a wider but still limited electorate, only about one-sixth of the adult population. Much to the Muslim League's dismay, the Indian National Congress won over half the seats and formed governments in 7 of British India's 11 provinces. What was worse for the Muslim League, its candidates won less than a quarter of the separate legislative seats reserved for Muslims. That is, the overwhelming majority of Muslims elected were not Muslim Leaguers. Rather than honor the Lucknow Pact, the Indian National Congress proclaimed that this election showed how unpopular and undeserving of power sharing the Muslim League was. Once in office, these Congress ministries alienated many Muslims by implementing some policies they considered prejudicial against them. Jinnah had been called back out of retirement to rescue the Muslim League, but not in time to avoid the election debacle of 1937. He was given full authority to direct and represent the Muslim League as its official, quote, sole spokesman. Further, during the years of World War II, the Congress provincial ministries all resigned since India had been declared to be at war against Germany and then Japan by the Viceroy without consulting them. Many of the Congress leaders were jailed for much of the war. During that time, under Jinnah's leadership, the Muslim League supported the British government and earned political rewards as a result. As negotiations for independence proceeded during and right after the war, Jinnah drove hard bargains with the last Viceroy, Lord Mountbatten, and the Indian National Congress leaders. Finally, all efforts at compromise failed, and Pakistan was partitioned out of India in August 1947. In the next lecture, we'll consider this partition process and some of its consequences for the new nations of India and Pakistan.